This episode deals with a crime committed against a child. Please exercise self-care when choosing to listen. Carol Stevens was a friendly, confident, and bubbly six-year-old. In April 1959, she was excited to be on her Easter holidays from school. The persistent Welsh rain couldn't dampen her spirits, and she was determined to make the most of the break, spending her days playing outside in the streets, near her Cattay's home in the city of Cardiff, Wales. On the morning of April 7, 1959, Carol was playing out in the rain, when her mother called her in and sent her on an errand. She asked her to go to the nearby shop in Dogfield Street to fetch some cigarettes for her and some sweets for Carol to enjoy herself. She left for the shop at around 11:30 a.m. and returned a short time later at around 11:45 a.m. She burst into the house in a happy mood, but almost seemed in somewhat of a hurry, as though there was somewhere she needed to be. She put the cigarettes on the bottom of the stairs, and her mother, who had come into the hallway to greet her, noticed that Carol had only bought 10 cigarettes instead of the 20 she had asked for. She pointed this out to Carol, but her daughter just smiled and turned away, saying she was going out. Heartbreakingly, that was to be the last time her mother saw Carol alive. Persons Unknown is a true crime podcast dedicated to unsolved murders and disappearances. The podcast is based in Wales, UK, and covers cases from Wales, the rest of the UK, and the wider world. New episodes are released every other Monday. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Persons Unknown Podcast, where you'll be able to see photographs from the cases covered. For a list of sources, please see the episode notes on your app. If you enjoy the podcast, please give us a review, and you can help others get to hear about Persons Unknown by sharing and recommending on social media. Thank you so much for listening. Now back to this week's case. Carol Stevens is sometimes referred to in newspaper articles, particularly in more recent times, as Carol Ann, or Carol Ann Stevens, Ann being her middle name. Her mother appears to have used just Carol, so for this podcast, we will use Carol or Carol Stevens. In 1959, it was common for children in the Welsh capital to play out by themselves. But when Carol didn't return at dinner time, her mother started to get worried and began roaming the streets nearby to try and find where she had gotten to. It wasn't long before her stepfather, who had been asleep after working a night shift, was also out looking for Carol, checking with relatives and family friends to find out if anyone had seen his stepdaughter. A short time later, the police were called and began some local inquiries and door-to-door investigations to ascertain if anyone had seen anything suspicious that might lead them to Carol's whereabouts. Following these conversations with neighbours and locals, a picture began to emerge of what might have happened to Carol. A picture that would lead her family and police alike to fear the worst possible scenario. After Carol had left her house after returning with the cigarettes for her mum, she spoke to a boy at the end of her road. Kevin Northcott was aged 6 and a friend who, together with his sister, was actually a guest in the Stevens house at the time. Carol asked Kevin if he fancied going on a trip somewhere in the car with her. Kevin replied that he did not want to go, he was quite happy playing in the street, and Carol continued on her way down the road. At around 12:15 p.m., 15-year-old teenager Robert Wilkins, who who happened to be the son of the shopkeeper who had sold Carol the cigarettes, said he saw her tapping on a car window. He described the car as a small green saloon car. The man inside the car was writing on some papers. This happened just opposite the junction of Robert Street and Fair Oak Road, only a couple minutes' walk from Malefant Street, where Carol lived. 20-year-old local resident Rosemary Morgan claimed she had seen Carol getting out of a green car in Fair Oak Road about a week before she disappeared. She knew Carol and wondered why the driver was dropping her so far away from her house. Another neighbour came forward, saying he had spotted a man the night before Carol's disappearance, skulking around at the back of the houses. He looked around 30 years old and was wearing a trilby hat and a raincoat. The neighbour thought the man was peeking into one of the bedrooms in the Stevens house. By the third day after her disappearance, police were increasingly worried for Carol's safety. Local wasteland, parkland, gardens and allotments were all searched. Door-to-door inquiries continued at pace, and there was talk of draining potentially millions of gallons of water from nearby Roath Lake. Cardiff City Police Assistant Chief Constable, Mr. Arthur Ambleton, made an appeal in the press for any witnesses. Carol was described as being 3'6" tall, plump, with a fresh complexion and rosy cheeks. She was also said to have a slight cast in her right eye, and sometimes wore spectacles. The clothes she was last seen in were a pink cardigan, grey skirt, and light brown shoes with grey socks. Great effort was made to locate Carol's biological father, James Lynch, who was an Irish national. James and Carol's mother, Mavis, had divorced 4 years earlier. Attention was turned to James as police were making the assumption that Carol felt comfortable and confident with the person in the green car. Police actually began to check ferries and ships sailing from the North Wales coast to Ireland in case James Lynch attempted to flee there with Carol. Despite struggling to locate James, police did announce that they were satisfied that Carol was not in Ireland. Police did track down James's mother in Ireland, who, despite not having seen her son in over 10 years, appealed for him to hand himself in to the police. James's mother, Carol's grandmother, had no knowledge of Carol's existence prior to the investigation, but despite this sent a rather bizarre proposal through the press to Carol's mother Mavis. She said that if and when Carol was found, she could come and live with them in Ireland, if Mavis was agreeable. The nationwide search for Carol's father finally ended on Monday the 13th of April, when James Lynch walked into Islington Police Station in London. He had only just heard that they were looking for him. James actually sent a letter to Stephen, Mavis's new husband and Carol's stepdad, offering help and support. Stephen apparently gave the letter straight to the police. James Lynch was able to prove he was in London on the day of Carol's abduction, and police soon realised he had nothing to do with his daughter's disappearance. It wasn't long before their attention was drawn elsewhere. Almost 2 weeks after the disappearance, some new information came to light. There was a report of a man acting suspiciously in the vicinity of a public convenience that was situated not far from Carol's home. The toilet attendant said a man reported to him that he had seen a little girl with a man who was acting very suspiciously. This occurred 5 days prior to Carol's disappearance. Apparently, the man had told the girl that he would take her on a trip to a chocolate factory. Police believed the girl was Carol, and that he was the man with the green car who had been seen dropping her off near the library on Fair Oak Road by neighbour Rosemary Morgan. Carol's friends from school were interviewed, and several mentioned that she had talked about a new uncle who took her for rides in his car. Police were desperate for information about this mystery man, who the press had dubbed Mr. X. They clung to the belief that someone local must have seen something and held the clue that would break the case. Everything changed on the morning of Monday, April the 21st, as the investigation went from a presumed kidnapping to a hunt for a killer. Carol's body was found in a ravine near the village of Horeb, 10 kilometres north of Llanelli in West Wales. That's about 100 kilometres from her home in Cardiff. Carol was found by a 31-year-old Ordnance Survey worker by the name of Stanley Rowland Jones. Her body was in a stream and could not be seen from the road, as overhanging branches and leaves obscured the view. The initial theory was that Carol's body had been hidden in a culvert, a tunnel carrying the stream under the road, but had been dislodged and washed to where it lay by heavy rains. It was an isolated and bleak location, surrounded by dense woods and hills, with the nearest houses being over 275 metres away. One of her shoes was found 1.5 metres away from her body, and the other 4.5 metres away. Her spectacles were also found. In a few weeks, the overgrowth of the surrounding trees and bushes would have meant the body would have been completely hidden and could have gone undiscovered for years. It was obvious that whoever did this knew the area and must have been there before, rather than just happening upon it as a convenient place to dispose of a body. The family who had been clinging to the hope that somehow Carol would return unharmed were left utterly bereft at the news. Mavis said she had known in her heart Carol was dead, but the confirmation brought no closure. Scotland Yard was contacted to assist in the case as soon as the body was discovered. Detective Superintendent J.M. Davis, a Welsh speaker, originally from the area of West Wales where Carol's body was found, headed the investigation, assisted by Detective Sergeant John Cresswell. Home Office pathologist Dr. W.R.L. James presided over the post-mortem. The exact cause of death was difficult to uncover. Carol's body showed no obvious sign of bruising or trauma, and poison was considered as a possibility. Eventually, the decision was reached that Carol had been suffocated. Newspaper reports published in 2020 claimed she was strangled, but the post-mortem found no marks on the body and concluded that Carol had died when a hand had been pressed against her mouth. Initial newspaper reports said there was no evidence Carol had been criminally or sexually assaulted. Later reports seemed to contradict this. What is worth noting is that Carol was found with her skirt pulled down to her feet. The autopsy gave an approximate time of death of between 7 and 14 days before her body was found. A verdict was given as murder by person or persons unknown. Police were still working on the theory that the body had been pushed inside the entrance of a pipe, and heavy water caused by prolonged rainfall had dislodged it and pushed it out. Manholes above the pipe that went under the road were searched, and one police officer even crawled 180 metres through the pipe looking for clues. An experiment was carried out with a child's soccer ball being placed in the pipe to see if it could be pushed through the pipe by the force of the water. The ball went most of the way through, but got stuck in a U-bend. The result of this experiment, combined with the lack of marks or damage to Carol's body, plus the fact that her glasses were still intact, suggested that her body must have been placed in the stream. The killer could easily have thrown the body into the water from the lane above, but he instead chose to climb 6 metres down the muddy bank, carrying the little girl's body and placing it in the stream. An early theory the police worked on was that Carol had screamed and the man had put his hand over her mouth, killing her, and then drove around looking for somewhere to dump the body. The belief was that Carol may have been with the man for some time before she was killed, and that he may have stopped at a shop or filling station to buy his sweets. They theorised that the man was an occasional traveller to Cardiff, perhaps a trader or lorry driver. In Hopkinstown, in the Rhondda Valley, around 20 kilometres from Cardiff, a girl aged 4 told her parents that she had been approached by a man with a green car. The little girl, named Margaret Ann Hughes, described the stranger as a person looking like her father. On her way home from school at lunchtime, and near a sweet shop, a man had approached her and asked her if she wanted to go for a ride in his car. She had said no and walked away. She said he had a green car and wore a grey pullover and white shirt. She described him as having dark, balding hair. She also mentioned that he had dirty teeth. She didn't tell her mother when she first got home about this incident, but casually mentioned it later in the day. There were other reports from Cardiff of a man approaching boys and girls and molesting them in the weeks prior to Carol's abduction. He was tall and approximately 30 to 35 years old. These sightings seemed to centre around the Splott area of Cardiff. A young 12-year-old girl, Lillian Baker, claimed to have been grabbed by her arm by this man, but was able to get away. The reports state that he was offering sweets to the children. Police also said they were looking for a merchant seaman who was carrying a carpet bag and was on Ely Bridge in Cardiff at around midday on the 7th of April, the day Carol disappeared. A motorist had stopped to offer the man a lift to Swansea. Police said they were looking to confirm if a car was in a certain place at a certain time. It could be assumed that someone questioned by the police had mentioned this incident as part of their alibi. Not long after police had mentioned the incident with the merchant seaman on Ely Bridge, the Western Mail newspaper revealed that a commercial traveller from the Swansea area was questioned by police for over 8 hours. Swansea is around 65 kilometres west of Cardiff and around 25 kilometres east of Horeb, where Carol's body was found. At this time, it was unclear what had led the police to this man, but the press did reveal that this man was supposed to have missed appointments in Cardiff on the day of Carol's disappearance. Shortly after police questioned the man from Swansea, an appeal was made in the press for anyone to come forward who had lost a dog, or who had seen an injured dog being picked up by a motorist. The incident was said to have taken place in April. Detectives would not go into detail as to why, but said it was a significant development. The police were basing their inquiries on information that a dog may have been injured on the approach road to Port Talbot on the Cardiff side. A person travelling to Port Talbot from Cardiff then picked it up. The dog is said to have been a black and white terrier type mongrel with black brown patches on its back. There was a specific appeal for a bus conductor who may have seen the event to come forward. The relevance of this odd incident will become clearer later on. Around this time, an identification parade was held at Cardiff Law Courts. 10 people were said to be helping police with inquiries. No one was arrested following the parade, but police did note that it had been a worthwhile exercise. Police also went on record to say at this time that they were convinced that someone was shielding the killer. The Chief Constable of Carmarthenshire and Cardiganshire which is the area where Carol's body was found, Mr. T. Hubert Lewis said that if the killer succeeded at evading detection, he may well do it again. In early June, around 2 months after Carol was murdered, a Swansea painter and decorator came forward saying he may hold the clue that could lead them to Carol's killer. Mr. Hubert Smith was somewhat known to the police. He boasted that he had helped to capture 3 murderers in the past. In 1898, Mr. Hubert Smith had witnessed 2 men fleeing the scene of a robbery and murder. Smith, who was a child at the time, informed his uncle of what he had seen, and the men were later identified and arrested. In 1921, he spotted a taxi that had belonged to a man who had been murdered, parked outside a neighbour's house. The murderer, a soldier, had fled the scene in the taxi, but Mr. Smith knew that the man did not own a car. Regarding the Carol Stevens case, Mr. Smith claimed to have talked to a stranger in Blackpool, Swansea, just 2 days after Carol was found. He described the man as being extremely agitated. He was trembling and a sickly white in colour. The man was slim and tall, and when Mr. Smith had stopped to talk to him, he had found out that the man was making his way to Swansea on foot. It is unclear how seriously police took the statement from Mr. Smith. Over the next few months, Scotland Yard, Cardiff City and West Wales CID chiefs were in constant consultation. People journeying from Cardiff to Llanelli, both along the main A48 and those making the slightly more arduous trip through the Welsh valleys, continued to be questioned. Altogether, 10,000 people were interviewed, with 1,100 statements taken, and around 3,000 vehicles were checked. Despite all this, the person responsible for Carol's murder evaded justice. So let's take a look at some theories about who killed Carol Stevens. In the decades since, there have been numerous rumours about who killed Carol Stevens. Some local people said it must have been someone who knew Carol. Early on, her biological father, James Lynch, was looked into extensively, but police were content he had nothing to do with it. There is no evidence that Carol's stepfather, Stephen, was ever suspected of involvement. Carol's actual time of death was only given as a window between 7 and 14 days before her body was found. This fueled the idea that the killer could have held her captive for up to a week before she was killed, and gave rise to endless speculation and conjecture. At one point, convicted child killer Harold Jones was linked to Carol's murder. He was sent to prison for the murder of 2 young girls in the Welsh town of Abertillery in 1921, whilst he was only 15 years of age. In 1941, aged 35, Jones was released from Wandsworth Prison, and his whereabouts after that are a bit of a mystery. He was in London for a time, but he also went by other names. He is often linked to another set of unsolved killings in London, the Jack the Stripper or Hammersmith nude murders of the 1960s. There were very few developments at all in the case over the ensuing decades, and poor Mavis Stevens, Carol's mother, died in 2003, having no answers about who had murdered her daughter. This may have been where the story ended, but in 2020, a BBC Wales television programme, Darkland, Hunting the Killers, highlighted significant new information on the case, relating to a prime suspect. Cathy Owen's article in Wales Online from November 15, 2020, excellently recounts some of the television programme's findings. Together, these are the main sources for explaining the following theory. The TV programme centred on a cold case reinvestigation team led by former David Powis Police Chief Constable Jackie Roberts, and including ex-police detectives, geographical profilers, and forensic experts. The information the team unearthed showed how close the police may have been to cracking this case back in 1959. One working theory back in the weeks and months that followed Carol's murder was that the culprit may well have been a travelling trader or lorry driver. In 1959, cars were still relatively rare in the area of Cardiff where Carol lived. In a street of 100 houses, there would only have been a handful of cars. The reinvestigation team speculated that the fact Carol was transported all the way from Cardiff to Llanelli meant that whoever abducted her was comfortable travelling long distances in a car. The detail that the man sitting in the green car Carol had approached a short time before she went missing was doing paperwork also led them to think that this was a person who used his vehicle for work purposes. The reinvestigation team got to work and revisited old newspaper articles from the Western Mail and South Wales Echo. They make no reference to looking at old police notes from the original investigation, and it is highly unlikely they would have had access to them, if they do still exist. With details from the news articles about the travelling trader theory, they began to centre their investigations on the fact that Carol was abducted on a Tuesday, and that at the time, Tuesdays were market days in Cardiff. The area Carol lived in was also at the time one of the main exit routes out of the city. The reinvestigation team also focused on Horeb, where Carol's body had been left. The site was so out of the way that it would not have been happened upon by chance. The person who hid Carol's body in the stream knew the place and purposefully went there to try to conceal his crime. Horeb was a tiny hamlet with only about 7 or 8 houses. There was a pub and a chapel, but no shop. The only place that employed a workforce in the area was the brickworks factory. The team knew they were looking for someone who had links to both Cardiff and Horeb, with a work background, probably in sales, or at least in a job that entailed some travelling by car. Their painstaking search produced a major breakthrough when a local historian from the Llanelli area, Spencer Hughes, provided the reinvestigation team with the lead they were looking for. The historian gave the team a memoir that was written in the Welsh language by former David Powis Police Detective Superintendent Roy Davis. He had written the book to detail his life and career in the police force. When Roy was a young police officer, he worked on the Carol Stevens murder. It was a case that stayed with him, not only because it was the first murder investigation he worked on, but also because he believed he had interviewed the man who, in his mind, was the prime suspect. The memoir talked at length about Carol's murder and went on to explain that Roy had interviewed a suspect called Ronald Edward Murray. A suspect who was not only a travelling salesman, but also had previously worked in Horeb. Ronald Murray's name had first come up when police looked over the list of people who had worked at the factory in Horeb. A large number of men who worked there were interviewed in the case, but Ronald Murray stood out as a suspect to Roy Davis. Ronald Edward Murray was born in 1923 in Australia and moved to Wales after the Second World War. He died in Penarth, South Wales in 1973, but at the time of the murder he was 36 and lived in Llansamlet in Swansea with his wife. Between January 1951 and April 1952, Murray was employed at the brick factory to repair chimneys. The reinvestigation team actually managed to trace a former neighbour of Ronald Murray from the time Carol Stevens's murder took place. What the neighbour shared with the team proved very interesting. The neighbour told them that Ron was quite an agreeable man and seemed to find making friends pretty easy. He went on to mention that Ron would fall out with people quite regularly too, because he was known to be untruthful and a liar. The neighbour said that Ronald Murray had a job that involved buying and selling sweets, and that the company he worked for provided him with a car. He said he thought the make and model of the car was a Morris Minor. He also mentioned that the car was taken by the police when Carol's body was found. The stories from 1959 of the children who came forward to tell of the man offering them sweets and molesting them around Cardiff. The account of 4-year-old Margaret Hughes from Hopkinstown being approached by a man with bad teeth outside a sweet shop. The witness who overheard a mystery man at the public toilets promising Carol he would take her to a chocolate factory. These statements and the revelation that Ronald Murray was a sweet salesman send shivers down the spine. Roy Davis wrote in his memoir that Murray claimed to have had an alibi for the day Carol went missing, and this is where the earlier story about the dog becomes important. On the day Carol disappeared, Murray claimed that he was in Cardiff on work, but began feeling unwell, so left the city and returned home. On his journey home, he hit a dog with his car, but stopped and put the injured animal into the back seat and carried on home to Swansea. When he stopped and exited the vehicle, the dog leapt out from the car and ran away. At this point, he went off to search for the dog. It's certainly an elaborate alibi, with details difficult to verify. It's unclear from the research for this podcast if the police were able to find a witness to this incident. Ronald Murray's former neighbour then went on to reveal a piece of information that was completely new to the reinvestigation team. The neighbour said that about 10 years after Carol's murder, Ronald Murray's wife, Della, had died in a strange accident. The reinvestigation team were able to find documents from the inquest into the death of Della Murray. In the notes they read that Ronald Murray had said he entered his living room to find his wife dead, with a strong smell of gas lingering in the air. Della had died from gas inhalation. Murray then gave a rather long-winded explanation about the death of his wife and blamed the tragic accident on a silly game he had been playing with his son that had gone wrong, with fatal consequences. As a joke, he would turn the gas on the hob off and then ask his son to boil some water and make a cup of tea for his mother. When the stove wouldn't light, Murray would find it hilarious and make fun of his son for, quote, not being man enough to make a cup of tea, end quote. Murray said his son must have tried to play the same trick on him, but mistakenly turned the gas on instead of off. The coroner gave a verdict of accidental death. The writer of the memoir, Roy Davis, had remained highly suspicious of Ronald Murray, and had continued to keep tabs on him in the years following Carol's murder. When he found out about Della's death, he spoke to her friends and family to get more information. In his memoir, he wrote that people who knew Ronald Murray believed that he had had a hand in his wife's death. Della's brother had kept in contact with Roy and had written to him from time to time. Roy said that the letters he received made it quite clear who Della's brother thought was responsible for his sister's death and for the death of Carol Stevens. There was some additional information, not in Roy's memoir, that the reinvestigation team was able to discover. The team found out the name of the company Ronald Murray had worked for when he was a sweet trader. His employers were Carson's Chocolates, who were based in Bristol, England, about 40 kilometres from Cardiff. Carson's used to give their sales team members green Morris Minor cars. This car is very similar to the description of the car Carol was seen getting out of some days before she disappeared, and also the car she was seen tapping the window of just before she vanished. One of the regions Carson's delivered chocolates to was the Cates area of Cardiff, which was where Carol lived and went missing from. The reinvestigation team even managed to get hold of some of Ronald Murray's old employment documents, such as his order requests, which included one for more sweets and chocolates popular with children. It's frustrating to read the revelations about Murray, as he certainly seems like a suspect that warranted further investigation. It's a fair assumption that he was the commercial traveller questioned by police in 1959. At the time of the original investigation, the police were convinced that someone was shielding the killer. Did someone back up Murray's alibi about feeling ill and returning to Swansea and hitting the dog with his car? Is that why he was not looked into further? One can only speculate whether Murray was part of the identity parade that rendered no arrests. Jackie Roberts, head of the reinvestigation team, made it clear that if Carol's murder had happened in 2020, they would definitely be passing on all the information and evidence they had uncovered to the Crown Prosecution Service. The case remains officially unsolved, and technically still open, as South Wales Police state that all historic murder cases remain under active consideration. As Ronald Murray died almost half a century ago, it is unlikely there will ever be clear answers, or that we will see the justice Carol Stevens and her family deserve.